Empower your leadership journey with the CEO Series. Whether you're at the gym, strolling, or commuting, our impactful dialogues with world-class leaders are just a click away. Immerse yourself in the minds of visionaries shaping today's most influential companies and innovations. It's not just an interview. It's a masterclass in leadership. Don't miss out. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and major streaming platforms. Good morning, good evening, depending upon what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, it is the CEO Series, where we bring together the most experienced senior leaders from across the globe and give them an opportunity to talk about their backgrounds, the careers, the trajectories, the detours, and all those kinds of things. So our guest today is a good friend of mine, Michael Foley. He's an experienced, highly experienced CEO, director, and mentor with significant business leadership and governance experience in Europe, Africa, and Asian market. He currently lives in Nairobi, which is where he's located today. He is currently the principal of the Runda portfolio, an assemblage of projects and interests ranging from M&A advisory, financial inclusion projects, sustainable energy initiatives, and emerging technology, to name a few. So with that, I welcome Michael. Hey, man. How you doing?
Ron, thank you so much. It's such a great pleasure to see you. It's always a charge to get together with you. We always have fantastic discussions.
Always. And last time we were together was in Pakistan.
Correct.
A few months ago, and we were both on stage doing our little thing and talking about the visions of the future. Well, you know, the reason I wanted to have you on, because your career is just fantastic, from telecom, and you've had senior level roles telecom across the globe. That's a huge jump from McGill University to become a global leader. So just walk us through that.
Well, you know, I'm just a small Canadian boy born in a small Canadian village called St. John, New Brunswick. I think the population still, some 63 years later, is 300,000 people or something like that. It's a small town. I grew up in Montreal. I'm French Canadian. English is my second language. I was very lucky to be able to live in a town with a great university like McGill. And I was graced to be accepted to McGill after a few 2 years in college. And McGill was a fantastic experience for me. And at the same time, I was an Army Reserve officer. So I was teaching at the officer school in Montreal, and I was enjoying this. And I had a choice after university to either have a career in the military, the diplomatic service of Canada. But I got an offer to work for Procter & Gamble, that great American company that you know so well. Yep, and indeed. So I switched from one army to another, from the Canadian Armed Forces to Procter & Gamble. And I spent my formative years in business, because I was a psychology major, at Procter & Gamble. And it was a massive change for me. I had never worked in a civilian environment before. P&G, after a few years, I leave. I run my own marketing services companies in Canada with a partner. One of my clients is Bell Canada. At one point, they say, you need to quit the small stuff and come and work for us. So I came to work for Bell Canada for a few years. And then a company which you know as well in America called At Home Networks, which was the cable internet industry getting into the business. There was a period of time where things went kind of sour in the technology industry, and it went to Chapter 7. It dissolved overnight. And then I started more of an international career. And I ended up being hired by a friend of mine from Procter & Gamble, who still runs one of the largest recruiting companies in Canada called Mandrake. And he hired me into Romania, believe it or not. There was a Canadian mobile phone company that operated in Eastern Europe. And I was in Romania, then in Bulgaria. And then we came home for a little while. And then I ended up in Africa. And I ended up in Tunisia. And I've worked now in telecoms in 10 or 12 different countries, either as a resident or a long-term work. Yeah. And most relevant in the last 10 years, I was with this great company from Norway called Telenor. Telenor is 53% owned by the Norwegian government. And I was the CEO for their operation in Pakistan first. And that was these are material formative challenges. Then they sent me to fix a problem in Bulgaria. I was back there. And then in a publicly traded company in Bangladesh, which they owned as well, called Grameenphone. And then about 4 years ago, I got an opportunity to come back home. Home was with my wife here in Kenya. I ran 7 markets for Airtel Africa until about 4 months, 6 months ago. And then I said, it's time to do something else. Then, and I wanted to try something different. There was no way I'm retiring, but I wanted to do something else. And this is when I started assembling a group of activities that I thought might be fun and interesting and potentially even lucrative, but really relevant to do. And this is why we formed the Runda portfolio.
Yeah, that's amazing. You've had so many U-turns, left turns, right turns, detours. How did you stay focused as to what would be next? You know, because we have opportunities that come at us. You say, no, I don't think so. No. Okay, let me try this. How do you choose, or how did you guide yourself during that formative period? Because we know when you get out of school, you know, starry-eyed, everything is going to be cool, and then it's not cool.
Yeah, the only thing I had in mind when I was in my earlier days of career, my dad retired from 39 years with one company, the Canadian Pacific Railway. He retired on a Friday. We had a Friday retirement party. We don't remember that very much. Saturday morning around the breakfast table, he said, Mom and Dad are going to Tanzania. And my dad had never been outside of North America except for one trip to Portugal. He didn't like it very much. Right. He's going to Tanzania, Dar es Salaam. This would be in the early 80s. And this was Julius Nyerere time and so on. And he was going to work for Canadian Pacific Consulting Service. He's going overseas as an expat. My dad did that for 4 years after he retired at 55. And the only thing he regretted is he didn't bring us with us because we were already adults or semi-adults. I said to myself, I will do this. I will give my children this experience. I will work outside of Canada. I will find something relevant to do. So the opportunities came because you were looking for them. You had to be patient. And when they came, you had to be courageous enough to take it. So when you're back in Canada, at one point I had to go back to Canada because my former spouse, you know, passed away. I had 2 daughters with her. And I was back in Canada, and all of a sudden I got an opportunity to go to Pakistan. And that was Pakistan when it was not a particularly safe place to be. Not the Pakistan we know now. It's quite safe. But back then it wasn't. And it took a lot of courage for my wife, Maureen, and my 2 daughters. They were all for it. They didn't know what they were getting into. To go to Pakistan at that time and to give it a try.
Yeah.
And I think the main lesson for me there is, you know, I've worked in Chad and Niger and all these interesting spots around Africa. You really don't know the reality because the news you get is a product of people who want to see your listeners come and sell advertising. Yeah. And until you get on the ground, you don't know. And it's been a wonderful experience for all of them. Sierra Leone, amazing place. All these countries were fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's the decisions amazing. Were made basically on what I do be relevant, and is it going to be a growth opportunity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think your father's path kind of paved the way for your thought process, because he never traveled really, and all of a sudden this opportunity came up, and he says, you know what, I'm going to try this. He does this for 4 years, and that's kind of said, whoa. You gonna do that?
We were so shocked. My dad married a French Canadian woman. They both didn't speak each other's language at the beginning. My That's dad moved from Eastern Canada to Central Canada to Montreal, and he was a meat and potatoes, devoutly Catholic Irishman. But he loved the world. Anybody was allowed in our house, as long as you respected my mom. So we at St. Patrick's Days, we had Orthodox Jews, we had Portuguese people, everybody was there for my father on St. Patrick's Day. He loved the world, but he had never traveled it. So when he got an opportunity to go and we were old enough, he went. And then they started traveling. And I thought, am I going to wait till I'm that old to do that?
Yeah.
And I said, no. And do I want to give my kids the opportunity to see a different part of the world? That's fine. Logan Lilly, my 8-year-old daughter with Maureen, has, you know, she's got 55 countries in her passport already. Wow. Because her global mom uses her as a travel accessory. You know, that's basically
global. She's a global citizen at 8 years old.
And she's the kid that, you know, do not take my passport. I will walk up to immigration by myself. Of course, immigration doesn't allow that, but that's okay. So to me, I think quite fortunate, blessed. And you know, you have to just make sure how lucky you feel. To understand how amazing an opportunity it is to continue to do this at this point in my career as well.
Yeah. You know, my first sojourn into the international side was I received an email from a search firm, and they recruited me to move to Saudi Arabia. That was, say, 7 years ago. And when I talked to people, I said, I would love this. And I said, if you got an email tomorrow, would you follow it up? And all of a sudden, you can see all these, I really can't do this now. And all these excuses tend to come into play. But if I would not have done that, I would not have had the career that I have now. And I noticed my good friend, I want to acknowledge Jim Moy, who's a big attorney in Washington, D.C., one of the big shots in Washington, D.C., was my next door neighbor, and we worked for the same company in Riyadh, because Jim came there possibly maybe 2 to 3 months after I got there. So we recruited him in, you know, as a legal officer, you know, in doing that. So the people you meet, like yourselves, and we go to these conferences, we're always in Pakistan speaking, you meet all these, that would never happen if I was in New York. Never.
No, it's interesting. We meet these people. I'll give you an example that you know as well. Dana Al-Salam, we met her in Pakistan. She's one of these incredible ladies. I'm working with her on the conference at LEAP in the next while, inviting Kenyan politicians to LEAP in Riyadh in the beginning of March. So I guess to me, the story is if you are afraid, you're never going to do it. If you put your nose out the door, you can go try something. The worst you can do is say, not for me. I want to do something else. But my best advice to people is do not rely on the media. Go and see. You will find something there that you will find amazing. And you, as a leader, you tend to learn how to adapt to the local realities and how people operate and what they expect. And Nigeria is very different than Kenya. It's very different than working in Pakistan. But leadership, the good qualities of leadership, you know, the candor, the curiosity, the compassion that comes with leadership, those things are standards everywhere. And if you are humble enough to understand that you may know your business, but you don't know their business, then I think you have it's a great opportunity for a career to be outside.
Yeah, it is a great opportunity. And I think Americans, for the most part, we won't go there with that, but they need a more global experience, because what they see here in that little vertical, they think that's the rubber stamp. They have no idea what the rest of the world looks like. No idea.
I see a little bit of that, but, you know, Ron, to be candid, it's not just it's a segment of people in each of the communities. We tend to maybe a stereotype Americans as being ethnocentric or you know, a bit close in, but it happens with all cultures as well. Yeah. You know, if you look at the international NGO community in a place like Kenya or in Chad or Niger, it's full of Americans who are out to see the world. And they're not all young kids kind of saying, let me backpack my way through with the United Nations or with they're people your age and my age who go out and do this. So there's a great, I mean, let's be candid. Americans have been the most generous people on the planet. They tend to get a little bit of a bad rap from time to time. Deserved or not is another issue, but sorry, go ahead.
No, you're fine. You're fine. So what I was just, you know, referencing and what you kind of cleaned up, you know, was a result that a global experience for people to travel, even on vacations, you know, even going to a different country. People will say, "Oh my, I see you're going here. Oh, I'm praying for you because of this and that." That's you can get shot tomorrow in the gym, you know. But anyway, so that's kind of the MO. But I don't really want to go focus on that because, as we said earlier, that could be another conversation, another 2 hours.
Of course, it could be. Yeah.
So let's talk about the. So you were able to make those decisions, and you were able to move here. And I know you gave us kind of a highlight, but we know once we've done that, it's not easy. What were some challenges you had as you were trying to make these decisions and to pick up from here and move into a totally different culture to start over, not start over again, but to pick up and go to the next step? What were some challenges you had? Oh, there she is.
Say hi, Logan.
Hey, okay, Logan.
Let you go. Let me do my work. Take care. Cheers.
You said that she was going to come in and say hello.
She comes in. I've been away for 3 days, so there was no stopping that. Okay, so cool. the challenges, I think, are first of all, you have to, when you come into a country as an expat, and I'll give you an example in Pakistan. There was two challenges here. I was the first time Telenor had hired. A foreign CEO into their company in 160 years of history.
Wow.
My first assignment with Telenor was to be the CEO of one of their biggest operations in Pakistan. So there's a lot of setting up and being humble, shutting up for 90 days. There's this whole 100-day thing that you got to get things done. For me, the best thing to do for the first 60 to 90 days is, listen, understand what's going on to the best you can, find out what the levers of the business are, and then develop relationships inside and outside the company. Mm-hmm. And that's important because you need to have multiple sources of information, because often when you're an expat, you tend to be sought after as an individual people want to have a contact with and influence. Mm-hmm. And you have to figure out who you're going to allow to provide you information and influence. And that can be industry, that can be regulatory, that can be political, that can be other kinds of suppliers and so on. So I think take your time when you go in and take time to travel the country. There's nothing more important than to understand that countries are not homogeneous. They're highly heterogeneous, even inside the country. Yeah. And that was the biggest challenge at the beginning, because that was a big bite to take and we had lots of security problems in Pakistan at the time. So that was managing those was a novel challenge for me.
Mm. I had a senior leader in Saudi Arabia pulled me aside and said, "Stop referencing the way that we did it in New York." He said, "This, you're not in New York." You're not in New York.
This is how we do this. Yeah, exactly. That's a reflex. But back home we do it this way.
Yeah.
You're not back home. One of the biggest challenges we had in Pakistan was when I got there, of the 70 senior managers in the company, one was a woman.
Okay.
One. And one. That was, I was working for a Norwegian company. And Norwegian company's social consciousness is very important. All this stuff is really, really critically important. So we had to find a way to change that and creating programs and then leading the organization to believe that this was going to be the right thing to do in a place which is, it's not misogynistic. It's just traditionally the way things happen. Yeah. Big influence of Islam in some parts of the community, not all of it. Although Islam is very, in my view, quite pluralistic when it comes to women in business. That was the biggest challenge we had in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see that Hamad, thank you for being a guest, not a guest on the show, but listening. And he said, "Before forming a judgment, walk the vibrant streets of another world. Listen to their stories, dine at their tables, and dance to the rhythms of their truths." My goodness.
Good Lord, you're a poet too, Hamad. That's fantastic. You couldn't be, it's about going to iftar. It's about meeting in the field. I mean, I traveled all of Pakistan by car. For the first 3 months, except for places where I wasn't allowed to go by car, because it was still a pretty dodgy place in terms of security in some parts of the country. But you're absolutely right. Candor, curiosity, compassion, these are absolutely critically important things. And you have to just be seeking the truth as much as you can. And that's the important thing for us.
Yeah. Peter, who's also a frequent listener, says candor, curiosity, and compassion. Those three, you know, will guide that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to be able to, even in the toughest periods, to tell the truth. Yeah. In Bangladesh, we had a massive challenge in that we're largest phone company in the country by far, largest IT company in the country by far, and we're publicly traded on the stock exchange of Bangladesh, which is a whole story in itself in terms of what that looks like. But it was very dynamic, and we were being unionized. And we were the first IT company to be unionized. And so the Norwegians who, the whole company is a compact between labor, business, and government. Telenor is 160 years old, so they're very pro-union. My job was not to resist the union. My job was to find a way to get the union in a reasonable way. Yep. And to bring them into the fold in a modern European style of union management, which is not what they have in Bangladesh. It's quite adversarial. And there was multiple people trying to run the union. We had all kinds of wonderful things going. That was a fantastic, and we relied on ITU and other organizations to help us with that as well. So big challenges, new challenges. It's just a blessing to have the opportunity to do these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is like you talked about, you know, listening, you know, shut up and listen. Where did you learn that? I learned it because someone pulled my coat and said, stop it.
You know, I had a very, very tough transition from university to Procter & Gamble. I almost didn't make it. I have to admit that. I was 22 years old. I had been an Army cadet from the age of 13. Okay. I had been extremely successful. I ended up being the cadet commandant of the National Cadet Camp. I was an officer trainee 1 year, and 6 months later, I was training at the officer school. I had an ego the size of the gross national debt. Okay. Yeah. And the first interaction I had with one of my staff, and I swear it's almost verbatim this, she was, I don't know, a 25-year veteran of the company, and she said, well, why should I do it this way? And I said, well, because I told you to. So that didn't go very far, very fast. And so I had to find a new way to lead if I was going to run through. And and in fact, at that time, that's a long time ago. That's the 1980s. I had not worked with women. Mm-hmm. Army cadets were 99% men. The military, very few women in the military. So this, oh my God, was I dysfunctional. Seriously, like the first performance review, see, leadership dysfunctional. I had good coaches. Somebody who said, you know, you got two ways to go. You know, we can turn you over, or you could change the way you're doing things. So I asked for coaching, and I had I was able to change. But so and over time, you know, that, and get good coaches, good mentors.
Yeah. So here's what I thought about when you said that. You said that you asked for coaching. I was pulled aside and kind of whispered in my ear. And then when I reflected on it, I said, I do. You're right. That is my MO. So I knew then that I needed to change. How would you coach a leader that you're getting feedback and they're saying maybe you should navigate this a little differently, but they still feel locked in because I've gotten to this level using my skills, and this is what I'm going to go with.
You know, the coaching process is repetitive. It takes time, and somebody has. It's the old, you can lead the camel to water, you can't make it drink, right? So, there are some people who make it, some people who don't. Coaching. Especially when people are entering into new senior jobs, it's almost automatic that I ask for a Sherpa for them or for myself, somebody to help them through the first few months or days, to accompany them, to coach them. That's one element. But if we have somebody that needs kind of an adjustment in the way they lead, then in big companies, or I rely myself or big companies on HR, to provide us the resources so that we can sit with the individual, have a candid discussion to say, you're fantastic, but here are the three things you need to fix. If they don't want to accept to fix those things, then they also accept the consequences of not fixing those things.
Okay.
And sometimes, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a whole set of things you have to do. You counsel, you train, you advise, you warn, all these. And not everybody makes the turn. When I decided that we were going to have every one of our interns in Pakistan for the next 2 years is not going to be, is all going to be female. All the interns are going to be female coming in because we have no balance. That anytime we're going to have a promotion board, there will be an equal number of male and female representatives who are being recommended. That went over not very well with a number of people in the organization. And in fact, in the internship thing from schools, I got angry moms because working for Telenor is the top job in Pakistan at the time. And now my son can't get an internship because, you know, he's not as well. I said, yeah. So, but we had to hold to that. It was it was fair. I'm happy with it. But the people who couldn't handle it had to go do something else. If you weren't going to accept that we're going to have more women in management, you should find some other place to work. Wow. And those are the toughest conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. You stood your ground without interference.
No, we turned over 4 of 9 members of the executive committee in Bangladesh when I came in because they were clearly not going to go along with this with a good heart.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. We did it gently. We did it properly. We did it generously. We helped people move on to another career, but you weren't going to work for us.
So you counsel a lot, you know, your new company, the Runda portfolio, you're working now with a lot of startups, I'm assuming. And that whole
two pre-revenue, one growth, one M&A, and one is a technology company that hasn't started yet.
Okay. Yep. What's the overriding theme to that audience of leaders? If you had the CEO C-suite of all those people in the room, what would be a guiding theme in talking through navigation?
Yeah. I think it's interesting, especially for people running new businesses or entrepreneurs. The leaders tend to be sometimes quite lonely because they're under huge duress and pressure. Yes. They have to focus on short-term goals or else there's no chance for long-term goals. That's important stuff. What they really need, because many of them come out of corporate world and maybe earlier in their career than I have, is they need somebody to talk to. They need somebody to bounce ideas off. So in one of the companies, which is, you know, not a small company anymore, has many hundreds of employees, but is expanding like crazy across Africa. I spent, I said, I'm going to help you with French Africa. I said, fine. And I spent 2 hours with the CEO, introducing him to certain political leaders last week, and 2 hours with him alone, kind of him being able to vent his ideas, vent his frustrations with me. And so they lack this audience when they're entrepreneurs. And that's an important part of why I didn't buy into these companies. They invited me to come and help them.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So that loneliness, because, you know, my mantra is social media has kind of said, you're doing all the cool things. You're the top of the pyramid. But they don't understand the loneliness. They don't understand the challenges these people have in trying to think through what next is going to look like. If they don't have, say, a mentor or someone that's kind of playing the role that you're playing, kind of giving them guidance, because as you said, they may not have anyone in their network to talk to, or maybe they don't want to share that I'm struggling.
There's a nugget in what you just said here that I like to, because leaders often fear to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
They fear vulnerability. They fear saying, yeah, maybe we need to think about how we're going to do this. Good leaders normally don't. If they're self-assured and they're strong, they can appear to be a little vulnerable and, you know, open to other people. But one of the challenges leaders, when they just to close themselves in, and that sense of organizational isolation becomes more of a psychological pressure to them as well. And they're afraid to get out. So that's when they need to talk to somebody. And that's kind of the role I play with some of the leaders that I work with.
Yeah. So you had built the brand up across the globe, but the areas they worked in that people felt that they could come to the run the portfolio of companies and kind of get guidance, you know, through not only the strategic piece, but the tactical piece, the coaching piece, kind of a one stop shop kind of approach.
When you're a CEO and when you've been a serial CEO, you start to pick up skill sets that, you know, are valuable, I think. And those can be about, you never lose the operational piece. This week I was out in the streets of Lubumbashi interviewing motorcycle riders to see what they thought an electric bike should be able to do for them in their market.
Wow.
Okay. I was out there with the team, you know, with my cap on, with my Watu shirt, walking and understand, because it helped me make a decision, and it was great for them as well, and great for me. Mm-hmm. On the other days, I sit on a board. I mean, you see, I sit on a board, and I'm trying to get people to understand the difference between good and bad. Sometimes that's what boards sometimes do, and that's part of the job. So I like having a balance between the two, and I love the operational stuff. I still think the best job I ever had was running a phone company in a country. Wow. That's just been the blast of my life, running Pakistan or running Bangladesh. Bangladesh, 80 million subscribers, 20,000 towers, one company, publicly traded. That's a ride. So those things, that's, you know.
You can't teach that in MBA school. You can't teach that in a university. So this is what I say to that, because I've heard a lot of stories like that. They said what I was thrown into and how I was able to figure out how to swim to get to the other side. They said it was stressful during that time, but it was the greatest learning ever.
Yep. You know, the funny thing that made the difference for me in many markets is I almost immediately, because it was appropriate, started wearing national dress. You know, so for me, I couldn't speak Urdu. I can't speak Bangla. Uh-huh. But when you are the CEO of these companies in those markets, you are essentially you're a national figure, a national leader. Yeah. As soon as the foreigner properly starts wearing national dress, it makes a massive difference. You are welcomed, you are hugged, you are touched, you are invited. And you are let into the club.
That's right.
And so in Pakistan and Bangladesh, and you'll see me in Agbada. I was talking to your producer in Nigeria. And I have a closet full of national dress from seven different nations upstairs. And it's fun. And it makes leading interesting.
I have also national dress. I have three different nationalities of dress. And it's different, even walking the street, because people look at you, they know you're not from there. And even the person in the store says, oh, and they say, where are you from? And they go on about what I have on and all these kinds of things. But see, these are things you learn when you're open to curiosity and trying to figure out how to get it done.
Yeah. And for me, it was an interesting trick or a tool for me to kind of feel that I was in the culture a little bit more. And in Pakistan, it was tricky because different parts of the country have different kinds of dress. Yeah. Bangladesh is very unitary in terms of they're all Banglas, almost all, but it was fun. And, you know, you and I have been around for a while. You know, I'm 63 years old. I'm still like a teenager when it comes to this stuff. I love it.
Learning is lifelong.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you figure you've got it all figured out, you're just coasting along till it's almost the end.
Yeah. And you can't stop. I mean, it's quite addictive. I've got one of the things, the reasons I decided to come home and do something different is I had done, you know, assignment in Pakistan, one in Bulgaria, one in back in Bangladesh, and then seven countries here in Africa. So over the last 10 years, it had been a massive adrenaline rush. Yeah. And one of the points, I don't know if it was part of your agenda or not, you have to take care of yourself as well as a leader.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I'm not afraid to say that after 10 years of, you know, the kind of security I had to have, the issues for my family, back and forth, sometimes they're with me, sometimes they're not, I wanted to spend some time at home and do something good for Africa and Kenya in particular. That doesn't mean I'm not going to go out and have another adventure with my family. but yeah. I needed time back. And that was an important part of the decision, not to accept the next assignment, which was Myanmar.
Sometimes
and
when
somebody
I
was looking. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So someone was looking over my shoulder because my next assignment would have been in Myanmar, in Yangon, just before that revolution happened where the military took over again. Yeah.
Wow. So my
family was back here and we weren't in Yangon.
So I get that feeling sometimes when I look at my calendar and I say, oh my God, I have a Tuesday off. No commitments, no Zoom calls. It's like, yay. But no revenue coming in. But you know what? It's cool to have a day to breathe.
I think you have to take care of yourself. We shouldn't forget about that. You know, you're not superhuman. You need to get some time to reflect and think and take care of your family and yourself. And I'd missed a little bit of that over the previous 10 years until I decided to come back here.
And
now there's so much open and fun. The question is, what do you pick? What do you choose? I'm at the beginning. It's only 6 months since I decided to step away.
Mm. So my other frequent listener, who's also a good friend, John Self, says, Marshall Smith got it right. What got you here won't get you there. So in other words, that bridge that you're constantly in a learning mode. Hamad said, leadership transcends mere positions. It is the art of embodiment of colors and contours of diverse color. Hamad, you need to be a poet.
He's a poet.
You've got some good wordings there, man. Diverse culture. Donair attire is not a costume. It's a bridge to deeper understanding and shared humanity. It transcends this. Thank you, Hamad, for chiming in on that. Cool.
You got it so right, so Hamad. It really is not appropriation. It's acceptance and it's humility. And that makes a difference. Sorry, sir. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. What is the constant source of motivation for you? You know, you're living in Nairobi. You've done all of these things. How do you stay focused?
Well,
you've got so many things pulling at you. You've got the careers that got you to here, and
Well, there's two or three sources of focus. I think you saw one come over and give me a kiss on the cheek a second ago.
So anything that
I can do to enrich her life, that's a great story. But from the business point of view, I think there's two or three things that are important for me. In telecoms, which has been the bulk of my career over the last 20 years, I could have chosen to sell iPhones in Toronto and Montreal or New York or Paris or France. I decided to build telecommunications network and work with teams that built telecommunications network in I don't like to saying emerging, I will call it economies in transition. And telecoms is fundamentally important. So the joy for me was doing something that was incredibly useful, that fundamentally changed societies, bringing in mobile financial services and mobile telecommunication services. That's a key focus for me. So in all the projects that I'm doing right now, there's one which is a financial services company for the bottom of the pyramid that's already funded $1 billion worth of loans and is now expanding from that market into other parts of the world. I'm working with them and they fund business tools like motorcycles and phones for people at the bottom of the pyramid. And they do it without doing one single credit check. That's another discussion. That's a fantastic company. Yeah. It's called Watu. Watu means people in Swahili.
Spell that for me.
Watu.
Okay.
It is a stunning company. And I was blessed to have a friend invite me to come and help them grow French Africa and spend some time with the leaders as well. So that's fantastic. A mix of both governance and kind of getting my hands into the dirt. Another company is a company that builds composite telephone poles and power distribution poles made of bamboo and plastic pipe in order to obviate the idea of cutting down 15 to 20 million trees a year in Africa.
Yeah.
Trees rot in a year. Concrete is too expensive and expends CO2. This company's in big trouble. I haven't saved it yet. My job is to help them save this company. Anybody out there have great ideas, you know, get through Ron to me. But this company is an awesome business that can help. And there's a couple of other things. There's a company, High Tech, in California that builds API sets for Metaverse, Web3, tokenization, and so on. Fantastic group of people. The challenge there is I don't understand anything about this 6 months ago. Learning a brand new language. And by the way, old dog, new tricks takes a lot of work for the dog to learn the tricks. And then there's some M&A work and other stuff that comes my way. So I'm having a barrel of laughs. I'm enjoying this. And hopefully it continues that way for the next little while.
That's amazing. Yeah, but again, it comes back to the learning opportunity, and you're curious as to how even understanding the technology behind it from a high level. It's not that you're going to get into coding and all that kind of stuff, but just understanding that, because I think what you bring to them is organizational skills. You bring to them leadership capabilities. You bring to them coaching to someone to talk to.
And networks and resources, and maybe I can help them raise some funds. They also, a lot of these young guys are trying to raise money, and they need on their team. They're not afraid to bring people on their team who's older and more experienced in some areas than them. So they have the maturity to bring somebody like me in, and I'm not going to step all over them. That's not my job. I'm here to help. And so I help with the fundraising and stuff like that as well. So it's really kind of fun for me, and I can't see myself stopping this anytime soon. Okay. We'll just have to see what gets served up and see what we do with it.
Have you ever given any thought to, because I teach at a couple of universities now, and I find that is so rewarding talking to young people, and they have the starry eyed about the future, kind of bringing them back to reality, walking them through that. Are you doing anything along those lines, say at an MBA level? You know, they're getting all the technical skills.
I've done it in some of my markets. I've done it since then as well. I've done it with HEC Paris in Qatar. They have an office in Qatar. And I've taught at LUMS, which is the Lahore University of Management and Sciences, which is a fantastic university. I think that's part of giving back. Yeah. I don't like the walk in and give 2 hours and walk away. If somebody wants me to come in and give, you know, a series of 10 lectures and I can structure it and put it together, then I can do that. And I take it, and I love the whole idea of the small groups. Maybe sometimes they come very big groups, by the way. But yes, I would do that. And I've done that in the past, and it's fun. And I can obviously do it in English and French as well, which is kind of cool. That's why I did it with that HEC.
It's called multilingual.
Not multi, but bilingual at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. But next step will be that. So as you look back, as you look out into the field of business and leadership, what would you say would be some key things that leaders need to pick up? Like, you learn yours through failing. You learn yours through because somebody pulled you aside and said something and guided you. Go ahead.
So I didn't kind of outline the four C's. I'd give three C's, but the one that I missed and I didn't talk about earlier is candor, courage, curiosity, and compassion. Those are the candor, courage, curiosity, and compassion. That's how I assess leaders when they come to me. Because normally when I'm doing interviews, they've passed the technical stuff. They've been through HR. We know they're available. I'm testing for fit. So it's candor, courage, curiosity, and compassion. And leaders, at the end of the day, have to find a way to be courageous.
Yeah.
And courageous means taking the tough decisions. It means taking the tough decisions. But the compassion means you feel it anyways, because if you don't have compassion as a leader, and me, that's a non-negotiable. If I don't set you up, then you're going to be a freaking sociopath in my organization. And I don't need that. Yeah. I don't need that. So if I have these four things, and I've learned by failing, by not taking a tough decision, by deferring it, by having somebody else do it, I've learned by, kind of varnishing the truth and not being as candid as I could be. Mm-hmm. I've learned by not digging enough and getting enough sources of information, not being curious enough. I can say with some certainty that I've never failed on compassion. Maybe compassion has taken advantage of me from time to time, but I'd rather be on that side of the equation than being a freaking sociopath. Let him be a sociopath, not me. So if you keep to those four rules, I think we're in a good place.
Okay, cool. This was a masterclass. You know, one of the goals of starting the CEO series was not to talk about strategy and all the business stuff, but talk about the people that are doing the things and what they've learned from that. And today you gave us a masterclass as to how that's done, a global masterclass as to how that's done. Would you have any closing thoughts on the interview today? Or
well, first of all, Ron, I'm honored, and I think the world of you, and I'm very grateful for the time you've spent. I feel blessed to have had this kind of career so far. I'm only 63. I'm starting the second third of my life. Okay. And I've got lots
Welcome to
go.
To the club.
I just wish that if anybody has any questions about, you know, they got young people that need to be, you know, to have this kind of view. I love talking to people about it, and I'm happy to spend the time talking to young teams and making sure that they get a sense of perspective that a failure is a temporary thing, setback is a temporary thing. You just got to keep chugging along until it hits.
Thank you, man. And I know you just got back in town. I know your daughter's waiting. She hasn't seen you. So thank you for carving out the time for us for the CEO series.
Cheers. Thank you so very much, everybody, for participating. Take care.
Okay, man. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Take the CEO series with you anywhere, anytime. All episodes are now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and major streaming platforms. It's not just an interview. It's a masterclass in leadership.